Well, hello from Atlanta, Georgia. Behind me, you can see a picture painted by a friend in Asia, a friend in Singapore, actually. We've had this for many years. We really like it. That's the background. Now, the background to this lesson, though, the Sermon on the Mount, is chapter 7, as Jesus is beginning to bring the message to a conclusion, and he speaks very, very directly. I've simply entitled this talk, Lord, Lord. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. That's our text. Seems to be referring to the judgment day. Just before this, Jesus had spoken about the narrow way, the difficult way. And we noted a parallel passage in Luke 13. But immediately afterwards, he warns us about false prophets, those who will not accept the doctrine of the narrow way. Now his tone becomes even more serious. Because up to this point, Christ has revealed himself as prophet and teacher, but now he's revealing himself as judge. Let me comment on some of the key phrases in the passage before we make application. You'll notice that the people say, Lord, Lord. And Jesus said, just saying, Lord, Lord, is not enough. Repeating the Lord's name doesn't save us once for all, especially if we don't respect his wishes and follow his will in our lives. And there's a parallel passage a few chapters later, Matthew 25:11. And you have the parable of the foolish virgins, those who couldn't be bothered to plan ahead and to be sensible. And they hope the rules would be changed just for them, but they wouldn't be. And they're standing outside, they're knocking, and they're saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But just saying, Lord, Lord, doesn't do it. In fact, this makes me think of Jeremiah's comments towards the wayward prophets, the drifting people of Israel in his time. And their prophets had their lies, peace, peace, temple, 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 and dream, dream. Jeremiah 6:7-23. So simply repeating something doesn't really make a difference. Now you may say, this seems a bit unfair for Jesus to reject them who had done miracles in his name. And he says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and don't do the things I say? And again, a parallel in Luke 6:46. Unless we're doing the things Jesus commands, doesn't matter. Doing miracles, that doesn't matter. Yet even though he proclaimed the sober truth in the clearest language possible, hundreds of millions today still interpret miracles as a sign and a proof of God's accepting their religion, God's approval. They stake their confidence and salvation on experiences, on miraculous experiences, either their own or the experience of perhaps their leaders. Don't do that. Don't do that. Miracles never indicate someone is saved or lost. And you'll find miracles being done by and in the presence of people everywhere on the spectrum, from certainly lost to very much in the Lord's grace. Jesus says, I never knew you. And I'm often asked the question, if Jesus is God, how could he possibly say that? But we're not talking about omniscience, knowledge of every fact in the universe. This is a relational knowledge, not an intellectual knowledge. And I find a helpful passage in 1 Corinthians 8 for understanding this passage. He says, I never knew you. 1 Corinthians 8:3, the apostle Paul says, those who love God are known by God. The Lord loves us when we obey him. Those who love God are known by God. And so it's a relationship. If there's love only going one way, if we're not serious as we should be, we're not committed to the relationship, then it would be correct to say, I don't know you. It doesn't mean I don't know that you exist, but we don't have that relationship that you seem to think we do. Now, in the notes that come with the talk, if you're in the underground churches listening to this, I've provided extra material from the words of some of the early Christians. I'm going to skip over that for the main version here. And, you know, in some modern Christians seize on these words and they say, well, these people must have never been saved. You know, they've done miracles. Yeah, they said, Lord, Lord, but they must not have been saved. This seems very unlikely, just to jump to that position to defend the doctrine of once saved, always saved. Jesus doesn't say that he's going to reject them because they were never saved. He rejects them because they're now practicing lawlessness. They're workers of iniquity. They are religious, but not doing God's will. I will share from one ancient Christian, Justin Martyr, the philosopher of Samaria, who ended up in Rome and was martyred in the mid-second century. Justin said, let those who are not found living as he taught be understood to be Christians, even though they profess with the lips the teachings of Christ. For it is not those who make a profession, but those who do the works who shall be saved, according to his words. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father who is in heaven. And that represents, there are lots of quotations I could give you, but that represents the view of the early Christians, that we have to be obedient. It's not just words, professions, it's not just experience or even miracles, but it's obedience. Now, you may wonder about that word lawlessness, because in the last verse of our passage, I declare to them, I never knew you, depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Now, does that mean they're trying to topple governments and preach a doctrine of anarchy? No, I don't think that's what that means. But he does rebuke these miracle workers. The issue of their authenticity, are they genuine? These wonders and signs, or are they counterfeit? That's irrelevant. It doesn't matter how authentic our faith or experience has been if we are practicing lawlessness, if we're the ones who are deciding what we do, not God. They live their lives as though there were no laws for the disciples of Christ. I'm concerned because a lot of Christians proclaim a doctrine of freedom that is not a biblical doctrine of freedom. Jesus does say that when we are disciples of his, when we abide in his teaching, we'll know the truth that will set us free. So yes, truth sets us free, but it's not free to think or behave or do whatever we want. It's freedom to serve him. But they live their lives the wrong way. The alarming reality, says David Berceau, is that this describes most professing Christians today. When they read the Sermon on the Mount, they view it simply as a collection of ideals to think about. Yeah, these are ideals. That's perfect. You know, sometimes they say, the last verse of Matthew 5, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. Well, that's impossible, so it's just kind of a goal, an ideal. We should kind of point in that direction. As we've seen in an early talk, being perfect, mature, complete is about holiness. It's about where our heart is. It's not so much about achievement, but it is about an obedient faith, an obedient relationship of love to God. So lawlessness isn't so much a violation of Torah or Bible as it is a failure to reflect the heart of the Torah, which is justice and mercy in our interactions, doctrine and character. May I repeat that? Lawlessness, as Jesus understands and taught it, isn't so much violating the Torah as failing to reflect the heart of the Torah. That is, justice and mercy in our interactions with others, our doctrine and our personal character. And you'll see that confirmed later in Matthew in 23:23. Lawlessness is living as though we're somehow above or beyond the requirement of obedience. You say, obedience? Well, obedience to what? Well, we'll make that a lot clearer as we wrap it up and summarize in the final two lessons. But let's not miss the force of this passage on the Day of Judgment. Is it possible that you or I will be surprised at Judgment Day? Now, there's some surprises, I hope. I want to be surprised. I want to see people there who I wasn't sure would be there. I want to see the Lord, behold His glory, His face, His majesty. And I'm sure that would be, surprise would be an understatement, a shock. But what about a negative surprise? Is it possible that I have substituted religion for a real relationship with the Lord? Religion instead of a real relationship where He would say, yes, my son, I know you. Yes, my daughter, you love me, I know you. Or am I banking on spiritual experiences and accomplishments? Maybe just looking at my past. Maybe, like the church in Revelation, I have a reputation of being someone I used to be, but I am no longer. Am I banking on the past experiences, or am I actually doing the will of God? What are the stories that I repeat to myself if I'm rationalizing? These people say, Lord, Lord. The foolish say in Matthew 25, Lord, Lord. Repeating His name is no magic talisman to protect us. It's no magic formula or password to hack into the divine treasury of grace. It simply doesn't work that way. A real relationship involves love and obedience. What are the lawless parts of my heart? Granted, we're all on the way. They're parts of our character, our heart, that have been trained to be spiritual, to do what Jesus says. But there are other parts that may be more difficult to bring into subjugation. So what are the lawless parts? Any part of my life that's not yet in full submission to Christ. Am I ready to give the Lord all my heart, just as He gave us all of Himself, both body and blood? Well, those are some questions to ponder before we have our next I Faith message, which is message Y, called simply The Storm. Thank you for listening. God bless.